Views, information, or opinions contained in podcasts do not necessarily represent the opinions, standards, or policies of DRWF. The inclusion of details about products or services does not indicate DRWF endorsement of them. The aim of podcasts is to educate and inform, and we endeavour to ensure that the information provided in them is accurate. It's not a substitute for medical or health advice from a healthcare professional who's aware of the facts and circumstances of your individual situation. We always recommend that advice be sought from your GP or diabetes nurse before making any changes to medication or before using any products or services referenced by DRWF. Neither DRWF nor any of its employees or owners shall be held liable or responsible for the accuracy or completeness for any errors or omissions in podcasts or for any damage you may suffer as a result of failing to seek competent medical or health advice from a professional who is familiar with your situation.
Hello and welcome to the latest podcast in our series, Living with Diabetes, brought to you by Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. I'm Claire Levy, and in this special report we're looking at the challenges faced by black and ethnic minorities in the UK living with diabetes. We'll be hearing from three people to explore this particular area of diabetes management from different perspectives. An NHS diabetes specialist working in primary care, who is also a clinical advisor to Diabetes Africa. A woman who was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes in 2008. She was recently shocked to discover that her HbA1c was in excess of 120. And a lady whose family is of Caribbean origin, with several relatives living with diabetes. Her own mother has had type 2 for over 20 years. In this podcast, we'll explore the specific issues facing black and ethnic minority communities in Britain who are more prone to developing diabetes. We hear their experiences and how to minimise the risk of developing type 2 or managing the condition if it develops. Our first guest is Dr. Joan St. John.
Hi there, Claire. I've spent most of my working life working in primary care, latterly been specialising in diabetes, mainly from a primary care and community care perspective. Very, very interested and always focused on health inequalities, health inequities. I've co-authored two books regarding diabetes and its care. I host a webinar on Diabetes Africa called Diabetes Health Matters, and I'm one of the clinical advisors to Diabetes Africa.
Do you want to just give us the titles of those books?
So the first book that we did was Carbs and Cals, World Foods, and the second handbook that we've done is the Foot Care Handbook for Dark Skins.
Fabulous. That'd be a really useful resource, I think, to signpost to. So yeah. Kicking off on this discussion, what does the makeup of the population of black and South Asian people living in England look like at the moment?
So we're talking from a diabetes perspective. So, I mean, our best guide is the National Diabetes Audit and the figures that we get from that. So if we're looking at the latest National Diabetes Audit, the percentage of people from an Asian or Asian British background living with diabetes is 5.2%, black or black British 3.1%, mixed ethnicity 1.5%, white population 86.1%, and any other ethnic group is 1.3%, and of note, ethnicity not stated or not known is 2.8%. So that's people living with type 1 diabetes. So conversely, if you look at the figures for type 2 diabetes, the Asian population makes up about 16% of that population. Black or black British is 5.3%, mixed ethnicity 1.3%, white ethnicity 72.4%, any other ethnic group 1.5%, and ethnicity not stated or not known is about 3.5%. So you can see the percentages of Asian or black ethnicity living with type 2 diabetes is much greater than it is for those living with type 1 diabetes.
Sure. And there are regional differences, I think, for these communities, aren't there?
I think you'd expect that. You'd expect that historically, given that people who may have come to this country initially would have gone to urban areas where the work was, the likelihood is, and this is demonstrated in, again in the audit, that for certain areas, urban areas, more likely are those with a higher preponderance of people from these ethnic groups living with diabetes.
And I believe the profile of black, Asian and minority ethnic communities is significantly younger than the white population. And does this impact on that type 2 diagnosis overall?
Yeah, it certainly does. What we found is that people from black, Asian or other minority ethnic communities are likely to develop type 2 diabetes at a younger age. So that is why there's a higher percentage of them represented in the population of people living with type 2 diabetes within England and Wales. So it impacts that way, that the diagnosis is going to be made at an earlier age, and the person from those communities is going to be living with the condition for a longer time.
And we're talking about type 2 diabetes being 2 to 4 times more likely in people from South Asian, and that covers Indian, Pakistani and Bangladeshi, and Afro-Caribbean or Black African descent. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the average. So if we look at South Asian, and I would have to include people from Sri Lanka, Pakistan, as you said, Nepal, other South Asian areas, then it can be 2 to 4 times compared to somebody from a white British population. For black African Caribbean or African Caribbean or African descent people, then that's 1 to 3 times increased risk compared to the white British population. So the average, yes, is 2 to 4 times more likely to develop type 2 diabetes.
And how does this risk of developing type 2 increase after the age of 25? And is it a difficult thing for people who are still young to accept?
I mean, as you would expect, for somebody in these younger age groups to be told that they have a condition which is a long-term condition, potentially, it, one, is initially a great shock, and two, certainly something that is not an easy thing to accept. If we think of, you know, our lives when we were in that age group, and I'm past that age group now, I have to say, you know, it would be an imposition that I would have to deal with. And I think that's what a lot of young people find. You know, they're navigating life, they've got all their things going on, and then type 2 diabetes is something else that they have to deal with.
What do we know about that increased risk of type 2 diabetes in these populations?
Well, as I said earlier, people from African Caribbean, Asian, South Asian populations tend to develop type 2 diabetes at an earlier age. They are therefore likely to live longer with this condition, and that can put them at increased risk of complications developing because of this sort of longer effect that the hyperglycemia is going to have on their bodies.
There will be proactive people within the Black and South Asian communities, so they may have been doing as much as they possibly can to avoid it. What's their response to a diagnosis?
As you'd expect, I think it's no different to any other community in that respect. Some people are aware of their risk and very careful about their lifestyle in terms of what they're eating, in terms of their activity, and yet perhaps because of genetic factors that we're not absolutely certain of as yet, they can still go on to develop type 2 diabetes. You know, they may have a very strong family history. And those people may be disappointed by the diagnosis, but their proactivity can remain and can continue so that they're still going to be careful, so that their diabetes management, if I can call it that, is optimized and they're still going to look after themselves in the best possible way. Now, it's not the case that people can do this indefinitely or continuously. It can be the case that sometimes things get in the way, whether that's life or whether that's other circumstances. But generally, if somebody is proactive in what they're doing, that will continue even after they've been given the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. And I think they can be almost like ambassadors for other people. So in every community, there are people who are like this, who have, you know, embraced the diagnosis and enabled themselves to live healthier lives sometimes. And, you know, they can be people whose voices we need to amplify so they can speak to people from their community about how they are looking after their diabetes and give them the platform to spread their message.
Definitely. And just touching on then how people who maybe aren't as proactive, what their response to a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes can be.
Shock, disbelief, denial, a whole gamut of reactions and emotions. I mean, it's a life affecting diagnosis. And as I said, it's a process. Sometimes people will be on top of it, feeling absolutely in control of it. Sometimes it's the opposite. They feel as though the condition is, you know, overpowering them. We know about diabetes distress. So it can vary at different times depending on what's going on in life, depending on what's going on in your family, your community. So all of those things can affect it. But the whole range of emotions that you would get from any community is the same as you get from Black or South Asian communities when they get the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes.
So what about cultural, social, family pressures that might affect their choices? How does that affect them, do you think?
Well, you know, people, whoever they are, want to be healthy. And, you know, everybody tries their best to do the best that they can. If we're talking about cultural or social or family pressures, how might they manifest? I mean, sometimes it's, you know, somebody's within the family might be a bit judgmental. Oh, I heard that Mrs. X down the road has type 2 diabetes and she's not supposed to be eating that, so why are you eating that? You know, this sort of thing. Whereas what we're looking for is the family, the social group, to be supportive of that person's decisions about how they're going to deal with their diabetes and how they're going to optimize their health. I mentioned it before, because we can't separate mental health, diabetes distress, from living with type 2 diabetes, this long-term condition. So we as an individual have to deal with it, but sometimes there are cultural, social, religious sometimes pressures that we also have to deal with. And I think it's more about trying to support a person rather than to be judgmental.
And there are some communities where there's no discussion around type 2 diabetes and people then keep the diagnosis secret from family and friends. How do we deal with that?
I'm not sure that it's about a community. I think it's about individuals and some individuals' choice. And some individuals I've come across have definitely not wanted to let family members, friends, work colleagues know that they are living with type 2 diabetes. And that can be very tricky to deal with, because if for whatever reason they're unwell, the people around them may not realize what the problem is or what the problem may be due to. And so again, it's about an informed discussion. But I've had discussions with people who will point blank refuse to tell anybody about their diabetes. And it's sad that there is this stigma around living with type 2 diabetes. And you can try your best to have that informed discussion, but with some people, actually, it's not possible to get them to share that information.
We'll hear more from Dr. St. John later in the podcast. I've also been speaking with Francine Daly, who was diagnosed with diabetes in 2008. She's gone on to run a health and wellbeing organisation. This is her story.
The funny thing was is that the doctor said to me, "Oh, you've got type 2 diabetes." Or I was pre-diabetic, and he says, "You might as well start taking metformin because it's a degenerative disease and your parents have got it. So it's you might as well start metformin now." And that's what, and then I got given a westernized diet sheet with food that I don't eat, and that was it.
No other support or help from any healthcare professionals?
No.
Nothing?
Nothing.
So how did you feel at the time? Were you upset? Were you annoyed?
I just went, "Oh, okay." I think I just went, "Oh, okay. This is what you're telling me." But I think because I didn't really understand what it was and the severity and everything like that, because my mum lived well with it. She was on medication. You see her do the finger prick, and then she goes about her life every day. That's how it was. And other family members, I had a cousin who was type 1, who often had a lot of hypos, where he'd run out of sugar and we'd have to run with the sugar. But that was as much as I knew about it. I didn't know anything else. So I just ignored. I think I just carried on with my life, basically. And I didn't take the medication.
You didn't?
No.
So what made you change then? What made you look for more information?
It was years later when I started my organisation. And I run a health and wellbeing organisation called 360 Lifestyle Support Network. And we were having people speak about diabetes. We started that in March 21. And then I started to hear the severity of diabetes. I know my diabetes levels was up and down because I think I went once a year, if I was correct. And then it wasn't until December last year, my sugar levels, my HbA1c went up to 125. And I took medication on and off, and I was on, I did take, through my diabetes journey, I did take metformin for a while, but then I used to feel sick on it. Then I went on to empagliflozin, 10 milligrams, and dropped the metformin, and that's what I used to take intermittently because I don't like to take medication. So sometimes I'm good, sometimes I'm good, sometimes I'm a rebel and don't do it. And then I've done things like intermittent fasting and watch what I eat, and my sugar levels came down. But the point was last December that made me really take it seriously, because we had a contract from public health with Mabadilico and a health equity fellow from our TLCP, that's the Lewisham Care Partnership, we did a diabetes and culturally tailored intervention based on the group consultation model. And I had to decide then that I'm leading the program. I can't be standing here with 125 HbA1c and leading a group, telling them how to do it, what to eat, what not to eat, because I know it all. Because I do know, I've had education on it, I do know it all, but I wasn't practicing it, so I had to. Plus, it was my big birthday in October, so that was another thing. I was turning 50, and plus, my health was really poor because I live with depression and anxiety and fatigue, anemia. So I had health issues that really affected me. And December, I just turned around and said, no, not doing it anymore. And started taking care of myself, taking the medication, watching what I eat. And then we started the program in April for 6 months with a cohort of patients, and then by October, by September, my HbA1c went from 125, then in March it went down to 84, then September it went down to 45. So I'm now classed as a pre-diabetic.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. So you've ended up helping yourself by helping other people to learn more.
Yes, that is very true. Because my passion is people and helping others and supporting and advocating for them. And the reason I started 360 was because of my own health issues, my own lifestyle, and I wanted to help others.
That's really good. And I think that there is that message there when you said you were given some information about a Western diet and that was it. So from your point of view, your organisation and your community presumably have much better information about diet and exercise for your peer group, really, the people that you're talking to that have a similar diet and regime that suits them more than just a simple Western, you know, meat and two veg.
Yes, yes. So we, on the program, we talked about foods that we ate because we did a session on what can I eat sort of thing. And it's food that is culturally tailored to us. So we talked about rice and peas, African dishes as well. So it was across the different cultures that we discussed what we should eat and how much we can eat. You can have a little bit of everything, but it's with consideration of portion control and mindfulness. So when you're eating, you've got to make sure that you're being mindful and have a portion that, you know, we all think just because you've got a big plate, you've got to fill it. And that's how we were brought up. You've got a plate, you take what's on your plate and you've got to clear the plate because there's other people who haven't got dinner. That's what we were taught. So whatever we took, we had to eat. But in reality now, as we've grown up, we realize that you can have a small bowl of food and you're satisfied. And especially if you intermittent fast, you know, portion control and things with the different types of education, we've got more access to people who do actually teach these things. So that's what we do. We educate and inspire individuals to change their lifestyle. So we do get speakers in who talk about plant-based foods, the variety and how to cook your cultural foods in a healthy way so that you're not missing out still.
And do you think it helps by talking about things like living with diabetes, do you think it helps that people talk to each other and get more information that way? I think sometimes people stayed quite silent and didn't want to discuss their health within the community. I think, are things changing there, do you think?
Very much so, I believe it's so, especially in the different cultures, because they say, you know, you mustn't wash your dirty linen in public and you mustn't chat your business, things like that, that you get told from you were smaller. But now, with me being open and honest about my health, I do have confession time when I tell them every month was confession time for me. I said, well, I had hardo bread, I had a scone, I had this, that, and the other. So they knew that I was being authentic and true to myself, and that you can live well with diabetes and still eat those little bits and pieces that they say you shouldn't eat, but in moderation.
The third person I spoke with is Jan King, whose mother has been living with diabetes for over 20 years.
Number of relatives have been diagnosed with diabetes, both on my mother's and my father's side. So a lot of living with diabetes in my family, a lot.
You've been involved with understanding type 2 diabetes for many years with your mum. So when was she diagnosed?
So took a little bit of working out, but it was 20 plus years ago. And I actually went to one of my first events when my youngest son was 4 years old, and he's now 22. So for me, it's 18 years, and for mum, it's 20 plus.
And that was a DRWF event, wasn't it?
It absolutely was.
How did she react to that first diagnosis all those years ago?
Shock. Disbelief, gutted, wondering what she had done wrong, whether there was anything she could have done differently, whether she was going to pass it on to us as well, which I've got to admit, I've never been concerned about it, because I know that my mum and my dad now have diabetes. It's just one of those things that, you know, I make sure that I get tested regularly. I try and make my lifestyle as clean and healthy as it can be for a 50-something-year-old woman with adult children.
So what about the Caribbean diet, and how does that affect people in the family who are living with type 2 diabetes or who want to try to avoid?
I think like most modern diets, there's a lot of carbohydrates, and that will always be the case. We've tried to introduce, you know, the usual things for a healthy diet, the leafy green vegetables, you know, salads, making sure that there's a balance there, and not just one meal, but every single meal.
But you've got lots of knowledge. How does your knowledge of diet, health and type 2 diabetes affect you and your family?
I am very conscious of it. I am always looking at what I eat. My natural response, and this is something that by doing this podcast I've come to realize, I have a natural tendency to avoid sugar and chocolates and sweet things. I know I don't have to, but I naturally feel better if I do. And I think I've instilled that in both of my children, because one of my boys is vegan and one is vegetarian. So they're, you know, they are very, very conscious. And I think the fact that they have been to events with mum and myself and my dad, it just kind of like reinforces it a bit. You know that I work with children, and we've kind of seen the increase over the years in the number of diabetics coming through, that whether that's type 1 or type 2.
Mm. What about other members of the family? Have they made changes to their diet and exercise by understanding more about type 2, and have you helped them?
Well, they called me the food police, as you know. I'm constantly saying about, you know, do we need all these carbs? You know, let's get some salads in here. Right down to Christmas Day, everyone's like, oh, Jan's going to bring her, you know, salad. She's going to make us all have some green vegetables. And yeah, I did, because, you know, I do believe that it's really important. There's a balance to be had, but if you're not having any, then it's so much worse than if you're having a little bit. And I think a little bit can go a very long way.
So how would you feel if you received a type 2 diabetes diagnosis?
Oh, I'd be gutted. And I would go through that. What have I done wrong? What could I have done differently? Do I drink too much? You know, are my cortisol levels too high? I would go through the full range of emotions.
Even though you know the genetics might, yeah.
Yeah, even although I know, I keep saying to everybody, I'm going to buck the trend. I am not getting diabetes. You lot can all have it. I'm not having it. You know, I will be doing things for my lifestyle that are going to prevent me from having it. You know, I get the statutory rolling of the eyes, but for me personally, I would find it hard to accept. I know that. I think because of living with diabetes with my mum, I don't want to do it for myself as well. You know, it's fine doing it with mum. I just don't want to do it for me.
Yeah. So how old are your sons now? And they've been involved with the grandma and her diabetes for many years. Just tell me more about how this has affected their lives, life choices and their jobs.
So my eldest son, Luke, is 25. And Zach is 22. So Zach went to his first diabetic retreat when he was 4 years old. He subsequently at university, he has done a degree in sports and exercise. And his thesis was on people living with diabetes and how exercise affects their lives. So I think that's had a pretty big impact on him.
Definitely. What's the other one doing?
So Luke is 25. He is studying engineering at Liverpool University. He's in his final years, masters, all kinds of things like that. And I think his choice to be a vegan has stemmed from probably conversations that we've had around food, because we're a very food orientated family. And I think most, you know, Caribbean families are, you know, everything really centers around food. Both my sons go to the gym. I go to the gym. So would we necessarily have done this if mum didn't have her diagnosis? I don't think so. I think we would have been a more typical Caribbean, second generation Caribbean family, where we were kind of like upholding traditions of, you know, our ancestors rather than making our own traditions and making up things basically as we go along.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, the DRWF podcast, and our special edition on Black and ethnic communities. Dr. St. John gave us some useful tips and advice, starting with managing carb consumption at celebrations, which people have shared with her on Diabetes Africa webinars.
So one of the things, if you're at a buffet, one of the tips that I picked up was to fill your plate with the vegetables first. So if you put as much vegetables on the plate as you possibly can, then you're leaving less space for the carbs and the protein. And so the chances are you're not going to overdo it on the carbs and the protein and have a tiny bit of veg. So you're reversing that process. One of the other tips I've heard is eat healthily before you actually go to that celebration. So hopefully you'll be feeling full enough, and so the portion that you have whilst you're at the celebration might be less. Or if you're going to go to the celebration and, you know, maybe because of societal pressures, you've got to eat what everybody else is eating, why not adapt what you eat afterwards and make that more healthy, so that it balances out? So these are sort of little tips that we've picked up from the webinars and from reaching out to the community and garnering their advice and their information. There is the book that I mentioned, Carbs and Cal's World Foods, which I co-authored with some wonderful other people. And that can also give you an indication of the carbohydrate content of the traditional food that you might be eating. And then, of course, there are some websites or healthcare professionals that will be able to give you that culturally specific information to help you and support you in those changes to your diet and lifestyle. Because, let's face it, that's the fundamental thing that is going to underpin your diabetes care.
And just coming back to the book that you co-authored, Diabetes Foot Care in Dark Skin Tones, that's alongside Diabetes Africa and other health and other fellow co-authors. Just tell us how important that is for an understanding of the differences in dark skin tones in diabetes care.
I think it's vitally important. If we look at it from a historical perspective, when I was at medical school, I don't think I was ever taught the different presentations or the different signs that you would get in different coloured skins. I don't think I was ever taught that, because the textbooks had been written quite a long time ago by people who were looking at a particular population and demonstrated and illustrated the signs in that population. If we're talking about foot care when living with diabetes, if these changes aren't recognized, so if we're talking about discoloration as opposed to redness, if we're talking about checking the temperature of the foot, if we're talking about not looking for perhaps for blanching, because it's not going to look the same in somebody who has dark skin compared to somebody who has white skin. So these things can be potentially leading to serious life-threatening, life-affecting complications if they're not recognised. So this is trying to address a disparity, an inequity, an inequality, because as history goes on, as our knowledge continues, we want to do better when we know better.
The World Health Organization's report recently talked about the rise in type 2 diabetes across the world, and especially in Africa, Asia.
I think that our experience in England and Wales is reflecting what's going on globally, that there has been an increase in the rate of increase, if that makes sense, of people living with type 2 diabetes, particularly at a younger age. So we're seeing an increased rate of people developing type 2 diabetes at a younger age. We have found from the studies looking at this younger population that people from black or minority ethnic communities tend to be overrepresented in that youthful population of people living with type 2 diabetes. Globally, we know that in Africa, in Asia, that the rate of increase of people living with type 2 diabetes is accelerating also. So I think what we're seeing here in England and Wales is reflecting what's going on globally.
So it's clearly important to raise awareness of these inequalities and increased risk in black and ethnic communities. A point I raised with Jan.
I think the awareness in all kind of demographics is really, really important. You know, I think there is a level of awareness, but there's a lack of knowledge about how much of something is optimal for them. So there's a natural tendency to want to get to the root cause of something, which isn't always possible with diabetes. I think getting the message across that, you know, diabetes is unique, that there is help and support And a good starting point, I feel, is all of those diabetic charity, the specialists, the nurses, you know, the doctors, just people who know more than you do, because I don't think that people necessarily don't know what to do. They don't know what to do first. They don't know what the first step is or what a good starting point is. And I think everything that I have either read or people speak to me, it's like, there's so much information. Where do you start and what do you do? That always seems to be the thing that's coming through. And I think that when you make the awareness relevant to, you know, like the population and their demographic, then that's when it becomes really useful and really, really powerful.
And we've worked as hard as we possibly can at the charity, but what would you say is the best way to encourage members of the Caribbean community to engage in that learning, be proactive in their self-management of diabetes?
I'm old school, and I think in-person events, the days that are dedicated to diabetes and being able to meet other people living with diabetes, you know, education around lifestyle, the Mythbusters, you know, there's a lot of information, but being able to just like weed out the noise and what's just not true as well, I think that's really, really difficult for people.
Dr. St. John adds that trusted sources of information are vital, but also emphasise that significant progress can be made through small steps.
It's very difficult to make huge, major changes, but small steps are something that's more attainable. I would suggest that people look for trusted sources and trusted voices. And I think that's something that came out of the pandemic. As painful as that period was, one of the things we learnt was, particularly for people from a black or a minority ethnic community, it was really important for them to hear from voices that they trusted, to be directed to sources that they trusted, to receive credible information that they felt that they could trust. And I think the same applies in the field of type 2 diabetes. If you're trying to make changes to your diet, which is totally ingrained in your culture and your lifestyle, so it's going to affect you socially, it's going to affect you at work, it's going to affect all aspects of your life, it's got to be those small steps, small achievable steps.
That's really good advice. So there are people who are in denial. They might feel different, isolated, emasculated and powerless by their diagnosis. How can we then persuade them to make better diabetes choices, learn some more through education and make some changes to diet and lifestyle?
I think we as healthcare professionals, so I'll speak as a healthcare professional first of all, I think we've got to recognise things like diabetes distress. We've got to recognise things like mental health issues. We've got to recognise that sometimes just life of itself is overwhelming to somebody and the diabetes has to take a back seat. So first of all, I think we have to be aware of that. When we're aware of that and we're alongside the person living with the condition, we can say that, you know, I recognize at the moment the diabetes isn't your main priority, but let's see what we can do to keep things at a reasonable level until you're able to deal with it again. So a sort of supportive way, and this is not just as a healthcare professional now, but as a family member, as a society or community member, as a religious group member, being supportive to that person and recognizing perhaps their diabetes distress or mental health issues, or that life is just overwhelming at the moment. There are strategies, so things like cognitive behavioural therapy can help with things like diabetes distress or other forms of mental health distress. And I think having an open door so that the person always feels there's the opportunity to revisit, sort of reignite their optimization of their type 2 diabetes, their health living with that. So sometimes we just have to pause and just let somebody get to grips with whether it's life or diabetes distress, and then revisit what we can do about optimizing the health of them living with type 2 diabetes.
And what about members of communities who just feel it's inevitable and there's no point in making any changes at all?
Yes, I've come across that. It can be because of a very strong family history. You know, all the members of my family had it, I'm going to get it. Or it can be sometimes from a religious perspective that people feel this. I think you have to understand where they're coming from. You have to respect their views. You have to acknowledge their views. And you have to have an informed discussion with them. You can discuss with them how to, I keep using this word optimize, because for each individual that's going to be different, but to optimize their health in the context of this very strong family history, in the context of their religious beliefs. How can we optimize your health? Because as I said before, I'm sure everybody wants to be healthy.
Great insights there from Dr. Joan St. John. So to conclude this special edition of Living with Diabetes, I thought we would finish on an optimistic note. Francine certainly believes if she can turn around her diabetes, so can you.
We run a diabetes support group every month, the first Tuesday of the month at the Waldron Health Centre in New Cross. So we talk about all different things. Mindset plays a big part, because that's what happened with me. We work on our mindset too, because mindset, without mindset, you can't do anything. If you believe you can't, you most probably won't. And if you believe you can, you will. So it's about waking up one morning and deciding to take responsibility of your own health. And I think you've just got to be open and honest with yourself. And it's no use pretending that you're being good when you're actually not, you know. Just being open and honest and truthful, true to yourself, be your true, authentic self in order to get results like mine. And if I can do it from 125 to 45, anybody can do it.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
And that brings us to the end of this special edition on the inequalities which can present greater risk and specific challenges of living with diabetes for Black and ethnic communities. I hope you found this helpful and of interest. I think a lot of advice we heard will be useful for everyone living with diabetes. There's also lots of other guidance and details on how to support the charity, together with the latest fundraising events, news and information on our website at drwf.org.uk. This is Claire Levy from Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. Our thanks to everyone who talked to us, and also to you for listening. This latest edition of our podcast, Living with Diabetes, was supported by Abbott.
Living with Diabetes is a Blue Aurora media production for DRWF. Copyright 2025. Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. All rights reserved.